WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It is time to be transported to early 20th century New York to investigate two mysteries. How did one man named Andrew Bevel amass such a massive fortune? And what happened to his wife, Mildred, who died young under potentially suspicious circumstances? Those are the central mysteries of the novel Trust by Pulitzer Prize finalist Hernan Diaz, which was our May Get Lit with All of It selection. To answer those questions, the reader is presented with four different accounts of Andrew and Mildred Bevel. The first is a novel based on their life, written by a man named Harold Vanner. Vanner's account portrays Andrew as a man addicted to accumulating wealth, and Mildred as a brilliant but mentally unstable woman driven to madness by her husband's immoral activities. The second is Andrew Bevel's outline of a memoir, which seeks to rehabilitate his reputation and claims that his saintly, fragile wife died of cancer. But is Andrew's account any more accurate than the novel? That's where the third and fourth parts come in, one written by a female writer, the other by Andrew's wife. Each successive section complicates and contradicts what we think we know about this power couple. Trust was our May Get Lit with All of It selection, and author Hernan Diaz joined me for a virtual event to discuss the novel. Here's part of that conversation. I remember you telling us, I think we had you on the show for a preview, and you were explaining some of the research you had to do. What are some of the things, I remember you telling us early on, some of the things you did, you read about women of this era, the wives of also very rich men of this era. What were you looking for, and what was something that you learned that you was really useful?
Weirdly, what I learned that was really useful going through these materials was not in the materials themselves, although there was a wealth of information in there about their daily habits, which felt somewhat suffocating. Maybe I'm assigning this to them, but some of these details made it into the novel. There was one particular woman who wrote, at home, you know, you know, page after page, you start feeling the sense of oppression. Details about their everyday lives. There's lots of lists and inventory, so you get a sense of the quotidian life. Two things were crucial discoveries. The first one was the restricted role to which most of these women had been confined within the household, which was a crushing thing to witness firsthand. And the second thing was that so many of these documents hadn't been touched for sometimes a century. So they had been archived, and they had remained there, you know, and I would open them, and they would be crumbly. It was clear that nobody had touched those papers in decades or maybe a century. So to this day, the voices of those women remain unheard to a large extent.
Oh, that's so interesting. What did that feel like?
It was very poignant. It was very sad. It was very moving, and it really shaped that part of the book a lot. For those who haven't read, there is one such journal in the book, and my experience of reading the real journals really permeated the writing of that part.
You know, I was interviewing one of the cast members of The Gilded Age, the one who plays Bertha. Carrie Coons plays this woman who has this great amount of ambition and things she wants to do, and her husband's this robber baron, and she exerts her power through parties.
Right.
Sort of.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting. And one thing Carrie said is like, well, what were you going to do if you were a woman?
Yes.
Who was bright at that time?
Right.
If you had ambitions,
that is completely spot on and real. You can see that in the historical documents. There's lots of luncheons in these journals with lists of Vanderbilts and Van der Rensselaers and so on and so forth. But yes, lots of parties. Yeah.
Let's talk about the structure of the novel. We got a lot of questions about this already. When did the idea for this structure come to you? This idea of a novel, an outline of a memoir, a researched piece of writing, and then a diary.
Well, it came to me. It's completely related to what we were just talking about. It came to me when I was trying to think about, the place that these women had been assigned in this world of extravagant wealth. For the most part, they were voiceless, as I was just trying to say, and to this day, they remain to a large extent so. So the thought was to enact this voicelessness and to play with the notion of voice and to ask myself, you know, who has a voice, who's denied one, and what better way to actually have a polyphonic text, have all these voices, and sometimes the speaker is not who you think it is, and sometimes you overinvest in one and underestimate another. So I thought it was a good way to invite readers to revise and reassess the assumptions with which we all walk into texts, right? And again, I thought this collection of documents was a good way to engage the reader actively in this process.
I do remember when I finished it, and I wish that I had had more time, that I thought, I want to read this again, because I think this is a different book the second time.
I hope so.
That's all of the revelations, I would want to go back and see.
Well,
all of those little twists and turns you just made.
There are a lot, I was hoping, I don't know if it succeeded or to what extent, but I was hoping that it would be a book that can be experienced on different planes. For instance, the big revelation at the end of, you know, who is Mildred in this whole story, to some readers won't be a revelation. Perhaps to some of the readers, it was a confirmation of what they had puzzled together along the way. For others, I know it's a surprise, and so on and so forth. You know, what's the relationship between the novelist in the first part and Mildred in the fourth part? There are clues in there to that effect as well.
We actually asked, and we hold our book club on Instagram in between when we first interview an author and then when we have you on again. And we asked if people saw the ending coming. And 78% said no, but 22% said yes.
I love that ratio.
The ending coming.
That's a beautiful spot to be in. Yeah, because you feel that if a quarter, give or take, of the readership saw it coming, it doesn't feel... I don't know about you, but I hate like big reveals that come out of nowhere. Like, it was the butler, you know, just out of nowhere. I like to be given all the elements to have an informed kind of guess of what the outcome of the book will be. So the fact that a quarter of the readers figured it out makes me happy. Yeah.
Let's start with the novel, though. Let's talk about the novel a little bit. So it's largely fictional, but there are some truths present about Bevel. What were some of the... I guess you might be the only one who knows the real truth. What are some of the sort of facts of his existence or the facts about his personality that did come out in the novel, that are true in the novel?
We're talking about the novel within the novel.
Novel within the novel,
okay,
yes.
Good. So what are the truths that
in
are...
In Bonds.
In Bonds, yes. I think Harold Vanner, who is the fictional author of this novel within the novel, gets a lot of it right. He gets a lot of it right. I think he gets mostly the relationship between Andrew and Helen right. And I was very interested in exploring that, because that is where also Andrew, who's this, you know, exceedingly wealthy, seemingly impenetrable, you know, mm-hmm. man, that's where his humanity comes out and his relationship with his wife. And he loves her very deeply and admires her and is completely intimidated by her. Mm. And to me, the interesting thing was that she feels no disdain for him. She tries.
She does try.
But she can't. Mm-hmm. So it's this dissymmetry between them that I think is the main thing that Vanner gets right. But of course, his great sin, to me, his great ethical shortcoming is that he invents this madness. He breaks her, mm-hmm. you know, in the way I feel that male writers have had a tendency to break women in the history of Western literature, you know. So that is a trope that I was interested in exploring. Yeah.
We asked our readers whether they thought Bevel really loved Mildred.
Yes. Oh, are you asking me back?
No, I'm curious. Well,
do you have stats?
I do.
Yes.
50-50.
No.
Yeah.
Love it. That's that's great. That's completely ambiguous. That's amazing. What do you think?
I think he had strong feelings for her. Yeah. I'm wondering about his capacity to actually love.
Ooh, that's very well put. Yeah.
So that's why the word love.
Yeah.
Gets me a little bit.
Yeah. No, I love it when I learn something about the novel and I just learned something. Yeah, I think you're dead on the money. As far as his shriveled little heart is capable of love, he loves her. But I don't know if that is, you're right. Maybe it's not. It doesn't come up to, chalk up to proper love, whatever that may be.
If you could pick three adjectives.
Oh, no.
That you think Andrew Bevel would like people to think about him, what would they be?
Oh, I'm so bad at these sort of games. I think self-made.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's what's important to him.
Audacious.
Mm-hmm.
And brilliant. That's the way he sees himself. He's a little exhausting that way.
He is a little exhausting.
Yes.
He really is.
Yeah, he needs to be.
He really is.
He has to be. He has to be.
You know, his relationship with Ida, I found so interesting.
Yes.
You know, and maybe it's, again, you sort of fall in the tropes. I thought, oh gosh, is this going to end up being a romance?
Right.
You know, are we going there? She's going to his home. We know what the time is like. Why does she feel comfortable going to his home? It must mean a lot to her to have this job for her to.
That's the reason.
To go to her this home.
Yes.
Yeah. What was Ida's reason for being so, I guess, willing to risk certain things for this job?
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons. One is simply she really needs the job. Her father is not very effective out in the real world, and it's the depression. They're broke. They need the money. As simple as that, and she needs to. You know, face these. And also I think she feels confident enough about her own resources as a person, as a woman, to I think the way I thought of her was always, okay, she thinks of herself as well armed for battle, you know, mm-hmm. intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectually. And I think she is. Like I think she had that happened, I think she would have had interesting tools and approaches to deal with that circumstance. I also think she's curious, so she wants to see more about this world and mm-hmm. learn more about this man, and she's also ambitious, which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. She's also ambitious, so she wants to affirm herself in this place and is fearless in ways that are unimaginable to me. But she is fearless.
I was so glad it wasn't a romance, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
No, also,
thank you. I appreciate that. And I think you're a more sophisticated person than that. So I appreciate.
But it's there for... It's an expectation that I wanted sort of to frustrate. Yeah.
Her dad is this... He's part of these anarchist movements.
Yes.
Why did you want to include this little part of history in this novel?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. Well, the secretary, and the word is incredible, right? It's a keeper of secrets. Mm. And I took that very literally. The secretary was a very important presence in American life at that period. It was the way in which so many women entered the white-collar labor force and ascended socially without marrying into the middle class, for example. That was very interesting to me, given the general topic of the book, which revolves so much around gender and money. So that was a crucial thing. I also knew that I wanted a contrast to this world of extreme wealth. And that contrast was to be found on the other side of the East River in Brooklyn, in Italian Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And that was a natural choice because, you know, at that time, that was the largest migratory movement in human history from Italy to the United States. I'm also half Italian, so that was also a way for me to engage with my own heritage. Mm-hmm. I mean, my family ended up in Argentina, but they could have just as easily ended up here. It's just a fluke, I think. And and also, the more I looked into this, I discovered that the history of anarchism in America has been completely erased. And look, I had access to very deep archives, very serious archives, and not even there could I find complete collections of anarchist journals and magazines, and of which there were so many at the time. And this was, going back to the issue of voice, this was also interesting to me. Though during those years in the United States, the 20s and 30s, especially the 20s, there was a chance for, a left to come to become a reality in this country, moved to a large extent by Italian immigrants, and it was crushed with extreme violence. And it's not something that is talked about to the extent that it should, I think.
Why do you think Ida's father was not able to pass this ideology on to his daughter? Or why was she perhaps not as willing to be as engaged?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's just, and I'm a parent myself. I have I have a preteen daughter, so you know, it's coming. The pushback is coming.
You feel it?
Yeah, as it should. And I think a lot of it is that Ida is a young woman. He is so strident in his opinions, and it's a black and white world. There is no nuance. He can never be wrong. He's always right. Who would be into that?
Yeah. That was part one of my conversation with author Hernan Diaz about his novel Trust. It was our May Get Lit with All of It book club selection. We'll hear more of that conversation and some questions from our audience next. This is All of It. You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We continue my conversation with author and Pulitzer Prize finalist Hernan Diaz about his new novel, Trust. It takes place in early 20th century New York and tells the story of Andrew and Mildred Bevel, an immensely wealthy and private couple whose lives become the subject of speculation after a novel based on their lives becomes popular. It was also our May Get Lit with All of It book club selection. Thanks to our partners at the New York Public Library, 3,364 of you were able to check out a copy to read along with us this month. And as always, our virtual audience had some great questions for Hernan. We'll get to some of those in just a minute. But first, here's more of my conversation with author Hernan Diaz. There were a couple of small moments that I just think about a lot in the novel, especially in the Ida section. I keep thinking about the butler not wanting to serve her.
He's a jerk.
He's just a jerk, right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Or is there more to that? Is
no,
it just,
there's, no, there's nothing else to that. It was just I wanted a butler who was a jerk. But also, it's what I imagine, too, is, you know, of course a butler is a working class person, mm-hmm. although, you know, they have all these airs and this kind of stiff protocol that they follow, but they're working people, needless to say. And it was interesting to me that relationship become sort of antagonistic, that he would be very hostile to the other working woman mm-hmm. in the house, you know, and he feels that she maybe has some airs because she has access to the big man.
Yeah,
know?
There's also protocol to be followed.
Yes, yes. That. But it's very much a gender thing, and this mm-hmm. internal weird class resentment that we see a lot, you know, and I think it's a thing.
It is a thing.
Yeah.
And one of the other most memorable moments was, so Bevel takes one of Ida's stories from her own childhood.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And recreates it.
Oh, man.
As one of Mildred's
yeah.
memories. So what does this moment teach Ida about Bevel? And what does it teach us about Bevel?
I think that's... Thank you, by the way, for bringing up the butler. Nobody so far has mentioned the butler ever. It's the first time. But the other moment you mentioned is very important in the book. Mm-hmm. It's very important because it's the moment where Bevel has hijacked a personal childhood memory of Ida's that she has written into, because again, mm-hmm. she's the ghostwriter, right?
Yeah.
So she has written that into his life, into his memoir. And he has accepted this narrative as true. Like now this is something, it's very vampiric, if you know, it's mm-hmm. very parasitical, and it speaks to precisely what we're talking about at the beginning, the nature of narratives in relation to power and the issue of voice, how all these great men, and in quotes mm-hmm. always assume air quotes, how all these great men end up believing the stories told about themselves, mm-hmm. and now this has become the reality of their lives, and it's all a fabrication, right? I think it's also most likely a very male thing, like to hear something and then quote it back to, you know, yeah. as if it had been his idea all of a sudden, you know. And it's so crazy when you're gaslit that way. And so, I don't know.
I just thought it was also, or another way I thought about it was, it's the ultimate privilege. I have taken what is yours and
yes,
mine.
Yes, exactly.
It is mine.
Yes.
I have paid for your presence. I have paid for all of this.
And I have paid for your words. And now you have sold me the scene of your childhood or whatever it mm-hmm. is. And now it's mine.
Throughout the novel, there are different ideas presented about what money and what it means in bonds. He writes of Bevel's relationship. He viewed capital as an antiseptically living thing. It moves, eats, grows, breeds, falls, ill, may die, but it is clean. Bevel says, all of us aspire to greater wealth because nothing in nature is stable. One cannot merely keep what one has. Hmm. Ida's father says, what is money? Commodities in a purely fantastic form. And Mildred says in her diaries, I was obsessed with the process. It'd be dishonest to claim it was only an intellectual exercise for me. I discovered a deep well of ambition within.
Yeah.
What did you want to explore about what money means to different people?
Well, I think you just really found the perfect spots. I feel I will be paraphrasing the passages okay. you just read. The thing about money and hence in part the title of the book is that it relies enormously on trust. The word as a title has many other implications, mm-hmm. but this is just one of them. And there's absolutely nothing material that links, say, a $100 bill to the purchasing power that it has. It's it's, you know, if you take a step back, all money is monopoly money. There's nothing inherently valuable about that, except for the fact that we all trust this piece of paper to be legal tender, right? And in this, money resembles language to a large extent, right? It's also a contract that relies on trust and convention and a strong sense of institutional belonging. And this is what I was very interested in about money, how it is at its core a fiction that we have all agreed to participate in.
I want to talk about Mildred's Diary. I want to make sure we get to it before we take some more questions, because we've been talking for a while. So she's keeping a diary at the end of her life. And my friend and I always have a saying, you don't write things down if you don't want someone to read it.
Yeah, diaries are mysterious.
They're mysterious. Yeah. These are my private thoughts, but I'm writing them down.
That's right. Yeah.
And someone might find them and to read them. And sort of this idea that maybe deep down inside we all think or hope or ponder that someone will read it one day.
Yeah. I mean, there's a line in there that says more or less, you know, a diarist is a monster. The writing hand and the reading eye are sourced from different bodies. Mm. Like the implication being the future self of, you know, the person who's writing the text, the diary, won't be the same person, strictly speaking, because obviously time has gone by. So this kind of monstrous quality or of a diary keeper has always been fascinating to me. I've always been unable to keep a journal because I'm too self-conscious. I mean, I end up becoming like a character, and I'm never there in my journals. I mean, the few times I've tried. Do you keep one?
No.
Yeah.
No.
No.
No. No. No.
That was a hard no.
Hard no. Yeah. Let's get to some of your questions. This is from Joel. Can you say more about the relationship between Mildred and Vanner? We have diary entries suggesting correspondence between them and a calendar ledgers that he visited the Bevel home. Is there more?
There is a lot more. Thank you for the question. There is a lot more. There is a whole unwritten book of Vanner in my head. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I was interested in having one of the central characters in the book, who's Harold Vanner, this author, never appear in the book, and he doesn't. In early versions, I had Ida maybe going out to meet him. Mm-hmm. He's an alcoholic who lives on Long Island someplace, and his life has been destroyed by Andrew Bevel. But I left all of that out. I preferred him to be spectral in the book. And there are other clues. I'm sort of hesitant. Maybe it's silly, but I'm hesitant to give them away. That they're little kind of Easter eggs about how they're connected. I mean, they're not. Again, they're not lovers. They were not lovers. They're friends. Yeah.
Let's see. We have. You touched on this a little bit, but I'll ask it directly. Why is the title Trust?
Well, the title is Trust. I was just talking about money and the trust that goes into money. Then also in the 20s and 30s and even before, trust was a close synonym, and it is today to some extent, of monopoly, right? As in antitrust laws. And Bevel exerts a sort of financial monopoly. So that was an added semantic dimension to the title. And lastly, of course, the emotional side, the human experience of trust and confidence, which has many different sides in the book. One being, well, which narrative will you trust? Can you trust the voices that you hear, and also, you know, what are the contracts that we enter into when we read? What kind of trust do we place in text in general, and what is the relationship between that trust and the power that narratives have over the real world? Because I believe they do.
Tree Story Time on Instagram. It was, what's your favorite fiction book?
What's my favorite fiction book? Ooh, I don't have one. I can name a few. I think Middlemarch is by George Eliot is one of my favorites. Now I'm reading her last novel, Daniel Deronda, and I'm loving it. I love Moby Dick. I love almost every book written by David Markson. I love almost every book written by Joy Williams. I can go on for a long time.
Yeah. I think you gave somebody a nice summer reading list. Why was Mildred so dismissive about music that was, quote, predictable? She used her math skills to predict the direction of the market, so she seems to value predictability.
I'm sorry. Why was Mildred so dismissive of music?
Music that was predictable.
Oh, I see where this is going. Yeah, because she talks about that's motivated by, in her journal, by a quote by Jean Rhys, also mm-hmm. a favorite writer of mine, since we're talking about mm-hmm. favorite writers, where she talks about Puccini and this music that you know exactly where it's going. And then she, Mildred, talks about sort of the classical form and this idea, you know, between tension and resolution and how, you know, the seed of a musical arc already tells you what the mm-hmm. fate of that arc will be. I don't know if dismissive is the word that I would choose. I think she's critical of it.
Okay.
And it has to do with this moment in history. Like, this last part of the book, The Personal Diary, is a sort of an ode to, again, the literature that I love, which is, you know, high modernist art and mm-hmm. literature. So the other composers that she is talking about, like, you know, Alban Berg, whose manuscript she buys in that. Mm-hmm. She talks a lot about Schoenberg. I think she talks about Webern, and so on and so forth. This is kind of the stuff that she's into,
yeah.
sort of this more modern, dissonant, serial kind of music. So she views the music of the past perhaps with some disdain, maybe.
What kind of research did you do to make the musical choices?
I follow two paths. One is just my I happen to like all that music mm-hmm. as well, so it was easy just to give her my own taste. That was one thing. The other thing that I try to focus on was the place that women, again, were assigned in the musical scene of the time, mm-hmm. which was usually had to do with patronage and philanthropy. And the few women composers, American women composers, you know, remained to a large extent, like Mary Howe and or Ruth Crawford Seeger, you know, they remain pretty much unrecorded and not very much, you know, they're not part of the repertoire to the extent that I think they should be. So, yeah.
That was my conversation with author Hernan Diaz from our May Get Lit with All of It virtual event. We spent the month reading his novel, Trust. Up next, we hear two special performances from Suf's creator and star, Shayna Taub, who was our musical guest. She has a new album out as well. That's next.